Support for CJSW's podcasts comes from listeners just like you. Visit cjsw.com/donate and join thousands of people who help make independent campus and community radio a reality for the city of Calgary and beyond. CJSW 90.9 FM. Broadcast in Bloom.
You're listening to The Drop and the Turning, a podcast about music, place, and change. My name is Rebecca Bruton, and today I'll be speaking with Berlin-based Canadian sound artist Chris Cole. Chris will be performing in Calgary alongside her partner Oren Embarki on October the 24th, 2022 at Highline Brewing. For tickets, go to newworkscalgary.com or bugincision.com.
So, hi, my name's Chris Cole, and my pronouns are she, her, and I am a sound artist.
Beating at 7 seconds is dedicated to all the different types of precious and common stones, of minerals and metals, while on the outside wall, marked all the rivers, lakes, and streams on the earth, as well as the wines, oils, and different liquids.
Can you think of and then describe for me a moment in your life that could be the first moment you felt this, or just a time you remember feeling this, where you felt connected to a non-human or more than human natural space?
Space specifically.
Or environment. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. The first time that I recall feeling connected to a space, human or not, or non-human, he said, but natural. Okay. I mean, it's funny when I think back to my childhood, I feel like I have a lot of experiences like that. So it'd be difficult to think of the first, but I often feel, and even when I think about my work and I think about my relationship to sound, I think about my memories of being a small child camping with my parents and this sort of space feeling very much outside of my normal day-to-day domestic space and being very acutely aware of everything around me being alive and the sounds and the sort of feeling of that I really loved. And I don't, and I know it's something I can engage with still to this day, and I rarely ever do, that sort of being immersed in that. But to me, that would be an early childhood. Yeah. That, or even just laying in the backyard in the grass. Similarly,
Sort of leading from that question, I'm really interested in this, what you described, even camping with your parents. And I think of camping as, I presume you would go to a campsite.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And it's interesting because a campsite is sort of a carved out space amidst a density of wildness.
Yes.
And in a way, it's quite the opposite of a gallery space. But in a gallery space, you're sort of, it can feel like a very pristine or blank space, or it's meant to feel like that. But then you're bringing everything else into that, or bringing in a way of thinking and listening. So one thing that I had been drawn to in my interest in interviewing you. Mm-hmm. I initially learned about your work because I read Music Works magazine.
Sure.
And there was a summer 2016 article by Crystal Jacks. And yes. I really liked at the end of that article, you talk quite a bit about your focus on physicality and objects. And I had a sense of animating objects, but not, it's not quite that. It's more of a pulling attention towards and through them. For example, filling a space with salt, where salt becomes this presence in a space, but it happens slowly. And so that made me quite curious about how in recent years you've been producing a lot more recorded work. And I'm curious about how you experience either difference or connection between these two mediums of constructing a composition for recording that will more likely be heard in stereo, as opposed to creating a multi-channel installation that has a visual and physical element and takes place in a specific place.
Right. Well, I mean, it's interesting to me the way that they, all of these things feel so connected. I mean, whichever medium, or I should say whatever context I'm working in, the way that I approach the materials, the way I approach my own equipment, the way I approach just the beginnings of how I want to generate sound is very similar, whichever context I'm in. The difference is that when I have an installation, obviously I have more, I don't know if I should say it's not that I have more, I definitely don't have more options. It's sort of, I, in a sense, have more restrictions, I guess, which can be good. But I think my ideas of immersion and bringing sort of engagement with small sounds or activating objects or things in my surroundings to pull the listener in is the same in both contexts. I just have, it's actually really funny. Sorry, my brain's going all over the place because I recently have two different exhibitions that I'm having to think about, and the spaces are really floating around in my head. And I really create for the space. I guess that's a big difference. When I'm given the opportunity to create an installation or an exhibition, I often am thinking very site specifically. Whereas when I'm creating a composition for recording purposes, I have the freedom to go anywhere and do anything. And I often love the idea of juxtaposing different spaces, different intimacies of sound within one composition, sort of as an interesting way of engaging the ear and sort of giving the listener a very experiential traveling through the sound piece. So yeah, I mean, I sort of feel like I've convoluted your question a bit. I'm trying to get back to the root of it. Actually, I'm going to ask you to come back to the points because my brain just sort of went off on a little tangent there.
Yeah, no, that's great. And I'm actually going to take that tangent a bit. So I really noticed that on your most recent record, A Piece of Work.
Yes.
Yeah. Listening through it, I do have the sense of being pulled into different spaces or being shown different objects, which is interesting because part of why I'm so interested in sound is that it's a non-object medium. Right. So it has kind of a fluidity to it. There is this sense of being offered a series of relationships. But something that I really enjoy about it is that it doesn't doesn't feel so much like hard cuts, like they're disparate sounds, and I can tell that they're coming from different environments. There's a whole section of percussion that sounds almost like chopstick percussion on it, mm-hmm. which is beautiful. But I feel like you've put them together in such a way that it makes sense and they belong to each other. And somehow it's very easy on the ears. Like it's not,
oh, that's good.
Yeah. It doesn't feel like I'm just being shown things randomly. I feel like I'm being given a very thoughtful movement through it.
Hmm.
That's not exactly a question, but that's an observation.
Yeah. I mean, it's very nice for me to hear that, because I often think a lot about my work in the context of Musique Concrète. And this, for years, I've thought I have this very this strong fondness for that area of working, and a lot of different composers that have worked in that field. And I feel that naturally my work, especially in recent years, has gone more in that direction. But yet often when you hear a lot of work from the Musique Concrète world, it's very much about sharp edits, juxtapositions, quick movements of sound. It's very dynamic in this way that's almost flashy. Not all, but a lot of artists working in that field. And that's never, as much as I might enjoy some of those pieces myself, it's not, to me, not or how I think about sound. It's not the way I express myself through sound. It's, to me, it has to have a more sort of organic connection. But I still love this idea of juxtapositions. And I always have, like the way that a sine wave can turn into a violin bowing, or a voice can turn into the sound of a synthesizer. And the way that these sounds, the blurred edges, are very interesting to me, that they're related, but they're also so very different from each other. And so to me, when I'm weaving my sounds together, it's very much about contrast, but in a way that feels somehow, yeah, that it has some sort of, like, they've grown out of the same soil, even though they don't really belong together, you know?
I'm curious about when you're putting a piece together, is that kind of relationship building coming from a sort of more unknown intuitive place, or is it conceptual, or is it both, or is it something else altogether?
I think it's usually a combination of those two things. Often I start with an idea or a concept, or I have a sound. So it might be something that I recorded while I was traveling, or something that I've been playing with in my own set of tools and objects. But to me, there always has to be some sort of a concept or some sort of a story in my mind that connects them. Not literally a story, but more of just a sort of this sound in this context is how I want to begin. And I really kind of create a lot of limitations on how far I can go with that sound or with that sort of set of tools. But then within that, I start to improvise and I start to have an intuitive relationship with the sound through playing. So it's, to me, it always kind of bounces between the two things. And I think I've been doing that the whole time I've been working in sound, which is now over 20 years. And so it's become very much natural for me to just go between the two. But if I'm working in a collaborative project and I feel like there isn't a concept or there isn't some sort of starting point as an idea, then I struggle. I really like to have something. Whereas in the past, I would do a lot of free improvisation with people and found that really great. And I loved that process, but I don't do it as much these days unless it's with someone who I already sort of have some sort of relationship where we sort of understand each other's sounds. So it's, for my own work, definitely there's always a concept behind it, whether it's an installation or it's a recording. There's always something that is a starting point that I sort of see through the whole piece.
What are some sounds or connections that you're really excited about in these gallery exhibitions that you mentioned?
Well, the funny thing is, for the two that, there's two that just literally in the last few weeks I was proposed to do. And so I actually have no idea what the sounds are going to be yet. One of them, I visited the space and it's this phenomenal large staircase. And the interesting thing is the other piece is in a small gallery and I haven't visited it yet, but I've seen photographs and there's also a staircase as a central figure. So in my head, I've got stairs going through my head and what that is going to lead to. I'm not sure yet. I still have to think about what those spaces sort of, how they speak to me and what that'll lead to. And that's usually how it goes. I mean, with filling a space with salt, for example, I had multiple opportunities to discuss the exhibition and to see the space and to look into different options within the gallery in South London. And suddenly, while I was on a train going somewhere completely unrelated, I just had this vision of salt. And I quickly wrote to the curator and said, can I fill the under, like the ventilation system with like thousands of kilograms of salt? And I thought he's going to say, no, no, you can't do that. But he was like, yeah, great. Let's do it. So it was only 375 kilograms. I think in the end it wasn't thousands, but it was plenty. But it's often, it like for me, the pieces come alive when I have the time, when I have at least a few months to sort of let a few ideas swirl around. And then all of a sudden something will just click. And then I just become locked into, that's it. That's what I have to do. And the material is usually related to something I've worked with before. It's usually something semi-organic, like the salt in this case. piece I did in Moscow a few years ago was repurposing bricks that they were used tearing down from within the building that we were installing in. Paper comes up a lot, things that can be sort of very tactile that generate a nice sound themselves that I feel like have a very sensual quality to work with. Yeah, but I don't really know until I start, until I'm in there and the ideas start to come to me.
Do you ever get bogged down by the sort of, I think the word would be semiotic, but that might not be the right word. Like the meaning outside of the sound itself of, say, paper or of bricks. And does that come into play for you? Or is that a concern of yours?
I mean, I'm aware of it, of course. And especially, I mean, I think because I predominantly have worked just in sound, and I mean, I've been performing with sound for so many years, and often I don't even really want people to see the objects that I'm working with. I don't hide them, but to me, it's not as important that they see what's on the table in front of me, and rather that they just close their eyes and engage with the sounds. So working with sculpture, bringing the visual element in, was actually really challenging at first for me. And my first few sound installations had no images or visuals. They were just audio diffusions that happened to have accidentally remnants left, like scratches on the wall from things that I had done in the space. So I definitely think about these things, and more, I feel almost it's a subconscious thing. Like the salt piece to me, when I was doing it, I was talking to a friend and said, you know, I keep being drawn to salt. I've used salt in a few performances over the last few years, and I love it because I love the tactility of it. I love the sort of the way that it sounds, the different kinds of sounds I can get from it, the percussive nature. And she was like, but it's so loaded, you know, it's such a massively loaded subject. And she was reading a book about salt at the time, which I now have as well. But all of a sudden I realized, not through that conversation, I started thinking, okay, there's so many ways I can look at this. Do I want to start analyzing it, or do I want to just go with the piece, just do what I'm feeling and then see what happens, which is what I did. But when the piece finished, it concluded with this beautiful little peak, this little sort of small mountain that came out of the top of the grid that had where the ventilation system was under the floor. So I had poured salt through this over the course of about almost, I think, over 2 hours. I can't remember at the moment. And then it ended with this beautiful little peak. And when I stepped away and I looked at it, I remembered trips that I've had in Japan, especially in Kansai, where I've seen these little salt peaks sitting outside people's houses, like a little pile of salt in a little pyramid. And that it was a way of kind of keeping away evil spirits, was this sort of, I think, a Shinto idea. And I'm speaking out of turn. I couldn't speak about it in great detail, but I remembered that, and I looked at it and I thought, oh my gosh, am I subconsciously having some connection to this? What does this mean? And then I got very excited about researching the materials a little bit, you know, more for future pieces, going, well, this is kind of, I guess I don't want to be driven too much by it. I almost want a subconscious dream sort of, like, I don't want to understand why I want to do it until I've done it. And then I like to look at it. And then you sort of discover things within yourself, even things from your own history that you're like, I'm referencing something I hadn't even considered. You know, this actually makes me nostalgic for something that I hadn't even thought of when I started making the piece. So I kind of enjoy that process.
Yeah, I find that really interesting, like specifically around salt too, because it, in a way it's so ordinary, mm-hmm. but then also incredibly evocative, and it's quite different and quite specific than, say, if you had used sugar or yeah. sand even. Sand would have been a whole different thing. There's something yeah. about salt. But yes, like the idea of the history of the salt and of salt and how it's been used in different ways. It also makes me think of, like I tend to be quite I think these things are relational, and we build up their meanings through context and how they're used in different ways, but not necessarily because, say, the salt is inherently spiritual or valuable. But then I also wonder, like, there's a specific being drawn to a thing. So is it something inherent about that material that's interesting? And maybe different people at different times have perceived of it that way, like the idea of the Shinto peak. There's a reason why it's salt.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's interesting.
Yeah. It's kind of my thoughts are like going and shooting in a few different directions. I should have had some more conversations today with other people before we did this. So I kind of, it's interesting because I think about the materials that I've been drawn to over the years, and they're always very banal. Like, that's sort of always been my focus. And part of it is not wanting to work with something that has an obvious sort of meaning or is clearly connected to some sort of a metaphor, or has, you know, the I'm like, no, I'm going to just use really simple domestic things. And one, it's accessibility. In the early days, it was also being a poor artist. What can I actually, you know, what can I attain? I can buy a piece of glass. I can find broken pieces of metal. I can go to a thrift store and find bells and little things. And that was sort of a lot of the origins of what do I have to work with? And then I thought the lot of these simple things like paper or sand or salt that we all have around us actually have kind of endless possibilities, what you can do with them, both visually and sonically. And so I thought, well, why the need? But I also, I guess for me also, a lot of the artwork that I'm drawn to, a lot of the film, a lot of the writing is quite simple. And what I love about it is that within that, practically anyone can bring their own experience or their own perspective to it. And they're not being hit over the head with it. They're not being told, this is what this piece is meant to make you feel, or we're using this imagery, so obviously there's a religious connotation, or there's some sort of it. I like the fact that it's sort of down to earth in a way where every person can make it their own, have their own, really their own view of it. And I think in a way that's something I've always hoped to do with my work, is just, it's very simple. And I hope whomever's listening or viewing it is able to kind of have their own interpretation because that's where the engagement happens. That's when something exciting happens.
Something I was enjoying earlier today with my coffee was watching your 2021 work, Valid Forever, which is a trio for two large similar paper things and one 5-pin bowling ball. So I really love this work.
Thank you.
I'd love to hear more about it. But my question that I had around it was, it's quite a minimal piece. It's available as a visual medium, so it's a video, but it's very much a sonic piece. And what I noticed is that it's like a lot of minimal work. It's durational. It takes place over a long period. But to me, it doesn't feel like an endurance work. I don't feel like I need to endure this piece, which
that's
is
a good sign.
Yeah, which is a good sign. But also, like, there's a lot of endurance work. Like, I know there's a Morton Feldman piece, one of his string quartets that's like 90 minutes. No, it's not a 6-hour piece. It's a 90-minute piece. So it's a piece that takes place like within the space of a concert, which is like, I think the 6-hour ones are become a bit more like installations or more like gamelan almost. And so something that happens in an hour and a half where it's just like the same chord being repeated, but with slightly different lengths on each, like each time a note is played within that chord, it will be slightly longer or shorter. And yes, like that is an endurance work. And I remember being at it and being surrounded by these four men, some of whom were professors, and they all fell asleep during it, which was quite beautiful, but I felt very like, oh, I stayed awake. But sorry, this is a bit of a rambling story. I didn't mean to have that happen. That kind of endurance work I deeply appreciate, because there is kind of there's a transformation that happens in perception. But my sense of this specific piece, Valid Forever, is it, I don't feel like as a listener and viewer that there's like a transformational goal in that sense. There's more of a feeling of a continuously unfolding curiosity. And so this made me think about the challenges of creating work with very few elements. And a question I often think about when I'm listening or creating is, how does the music change? What qualities of change are you working with? So I'm curious, in a piece like that, how are you working with change? How do you think about interest or development when you're working with so few materials?
Sure. I mean, in a way, it's funny because to me, I feel, even though I know that that piece is minimal, to me, it's not that minimal because I used to do things that were even more extreme. pardon me. So I mean, generally speaking, obviously you refer to a piece of work which has a lot more diversity of sound sources, a lot more sort of movements within the composition, whereas Valid Forever is really specific. It's really specific to a score that was used as an inspiration, which is a piece by Beth Anderson called Valid for Life. And this was a graphic score that was meant for to be a trio for three instruments. And it has all these beautiful rolling R's, text R's, sort of like almost like a text collage of different types of R's. And when I saw it, I thought, I want to take this and run with it. And I immediately heard rolling R's or something rolling in my head. And I had done a piece several years ago called Keeping the Ball Rolling, which was sort of me trying to keep myself active during a particularly frustrating period where I couldn't be out performing. And I did this piece where I just kept a bowling ball rolling around in a gallery space for as long as I could with a partner. And so I had this recording and I thought, okay, this is sort of the stem of this piece. And to me, I guess, to go back to your question, I think that when I'm working, I'm so used to working with only a few materials, or you could say a few instruments, kind of like if you had a string quartet or you have a small ensemble of woodwinds or something like that. And you build your composition from these sound sources. The only difference is when you're dealing with like a rolling ball or fluttering sheets of paper, the dimension of sound is definitely, in a sense, smaller than what you could do with, say, a saxophone or a cello. But I think my approach is kind of similar. I'm sort of thinking about, in this piece in particular, although I was only working with the three sheets of paper and the bowling ball, I did lots of multi-tracking. So in a sense, it became a much larger ensemble than it was on paper, because I was recording different techniques. I was using different microphones to capture different dimensions of the sound, EQing differently. So I had all of these different ways of sort of taking that material and bringing out different dimensions and textures and rhythms from it. And so when I put the piece together, I'm always very much aware of keeping the ear interested. But to me, obviously, that's different for every person, what that means. But for me, I like to kind of keep things simple to begin and then bring in very slight changes. So even a slight change in the EQ, even a slight change in the dimension of the sound. So in the panning of the sounds in a recording, if a sound is all centered and then suddenly you bring in something far from the left channel, and then it suddenly the ear goes, oh, what's happening over there? Like there's all these interesting ways that you can play with sound that are very subtle, but that keep the ear engaged. And I mean, I'm also a fan. It's funny, the Feldman piece you mentioned, I've also seen it live, and I had to play after it. So it was really challenging because I'm like, stay awake, be here, be present. You got to play after this, you know? But I love those pieces too. I love long duration pieces, especially when I don't expect to end up anywhere different than where we started, but I love this journey. I mean, of being kind of in this experience with the musicians as it's happening or with the sound. And I have done very long pieces where really, if you really want to hear what's happened, you would have to. Filling a Space is a piece like that where it's, I wish I could remember, it's like 120 or 132 minutes or something. It's really long, but it starts very sounding one way, and by the end it sounds quite different. But in the gallery, if you come in at any point, you're not going to hear that transition. And I don't expect people to, but I'm happy if somebody does. I mean, in a performance setting, I think I am engaging the ear. I'm trying to engage the ear with small changes more consistently than I would do with an installation. The installation, I feel like it can sort of be, and I let the audience choose how much time they want to spend with it. But for a performance, if it's long, if it's like a 30, 40 minute performance, then I definitely am guided by subtle changes that keep, yeah, that keep the listener kind of connected to what you're doing. It's like I want to stay in contact with the audience. Mm.
When you perform, do you play any more traditional instruments, or is it, I'm curious about how, because I'm less familiar with your performance practice, I'm curious about how you, what kinds of materials you might have with on you, you have with you on stage, for example, contact mics or a laptop or all of those things, or analog instruments. Sure. Yeah.
I don't ever perform with a computer. Although I have to say, with certain pieces that I've done lately, I have had to have some playback because they sort of have, they have compositional elements that I can't do live. Like a recording, field recordings or percussion sections that I don't do live, things like that. But generally speaking, I have contact mics are sort of one of my, you'll rarely ever see me perform without at least one contact mic. And vocal mics for either voice or amplifying objects. I also play with flutes, which has become something I've been doing a lot more in the last few years. Wooden flutes, bass recorders, ocarinas, things like that. And it, depending on the project, I do have, because I'm not a trained musician in any traditional sense. So I don't really have things I always go to, but there are instruments that have come into some of my pieces or some of my collaborations. I use organ in my collaboration with Oren Ambarchi and also with James Rushford in Ora Clementi, which Ora Clementi, we've used a lot of instruments. We've used synthesizers, we've used drums, we've used actual singing, which is quite unusual for me and was confrontational, but actually really great. And yeah, often it's more keys. We did a piano piece. We had a piano section in one of our tracks, Ora Clementi, and we did that live as well. So there's, yeah, so it comes in as I feel it's needed or as the collaboration sort of demands. But if I'm doing a solo performance, the only thing that's more of a traditional instrument that I would use is a flute, probably. Mm-hmm. Which to me is almost like an extension of the voice, which is why I love flutes.
Interesting. That's interesting. And yet bringing in singing, it sounds like was a very somewhat radical experience for you.
Yes. Yes. I mean, there's a lot of baggage behind that too, because as a woman working in music, for years, it was just presumed that I was a singer, and from day one, oh, you want to make music? Oh, so you want to sing? And I'm like, no, I don't want to sing. I want to play with feedback and, you know, broken electronics, actually. But so when I started to use the voice, I was very self-conscious about being a woman using my voice. And I resisted it for many years. But then with Ora Clementi, I found a way to use it in a way I was very happy with and I really enjoyed. And then I ended up doing an entire spoken piece on one of my solo records as well, which was a surprise to me. But the piece dictated it and I liked the piece. So
yeah, that's fascinating. That's the female singer, a very loaded topic.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and even thinking about how the singer takes up space on stage, and what I know in free improvisation settings, the moment there's a singer, it really, at least my experience of it is that the attention shifts to the singer. I think for one, because it's from the body, and I think it is vulnerable in a way, particularly like a lot of extended techniques being used in experimental music and improvised music. But also because we're so accustomed to the spectacle of the singer, and there's so much baggage and history around it, good and bad, not to denigrate that tradition, but I find that quite fascinating.
It's interesting to see. I had a conversation with an older composer friend of mine about, because she actually asked me, so you've been using voice a bit more lately. What's that all about? And she, no judgment. She was just genuinely curious. And I said to her how I was finding it so fascinating, the way that audiences and listeners, even to my records, responded when my voice came into it. And I said, it's wild, because it truly is, the audience sort of locks in more. And I've seen it in many contexts of performance, concerts, where as soon as someone sings or speaks, the audience is immediately captivated. And you're right, though, the one we're used to that, it's like whatever it is, there's someone on stage talking to us, there's the teacher at the front of the class, there's someone, you know, there's an authority in voice, there's, oh, what do they have to say, what's happening here? But also there's a human aspect to it. Like you say, the contact with the body, like it's so clear. And it's something we all can sort of relate to. We all have a voice. You can't just pick up a guitar necessarily and play and sit at a piano and do a beautiful concert, but we all have voices. We can all sort of sing at least.
Yeah. Well, I think something that I'm drawn to with the idea of musicians who don't historically work with voice, or who are working with different other ways of listening and attention, mm-hmm. is that, and something we were talking about earlier is the ordinariness of the instruments that you're using or the objects that you're using. And I find there's something really beautiful about hearing voices that aren't necessarily singer voices.
Yeah.
I think there's also something about your body of work has framed unusual sound sources and sort of drawn in attention to these ordinary things that maybe we don't think of as sound objects. And then I think in a way, by then putting your voice in that context, then there's also an ordinary, like the voice can be just ordinary as well.
Absolutely.
Did you want to add something there?
No, I was just thinking about kind of the usual thing where you start to think about your own work and you realize that there's things that you did years ago that tie to this that you kind of didn't even realize. Like the first record I did with my partner, Oren, was a very intimate collage, very much like a musique concrète piece that we made together. And a lot of the recordings were very personal, taken in our private space. And our voices are in there, not clear, but they kind of occur at points. And I just thought about how that I love that piece very much. I mean, it has a emotionally and historically it's important to me, but also I love that sort of feeling of creating this very intimate space that anyone could listen to and sort of relate to in an interesting way, because the voices are obscured, but there's still this very sort of intimate and personal feeling to the sounds. Which in a way I'd never thought of it as a voice piece, but actually the voices are kind of integral to that work and to the effect that the work has. Anyways, yeah, it's just interesting to, you start to think about things you've done. I mean, this was 11, 12 years ago, I think, this piece that I'm thinking of. So, and I thought, oh, no, I don't use voice. But wait, actually,
yeah,
I kind of did accidentally.
So the big question I don't know what it's like for you in Berlin. I spoke recently. I don't know if you know Chioko Slavniks, another Canadian.
I've seen her perform, but I actually, or pieces of hers, but I've not actually met her.
Okay. Lovely human. But I spoke to her, over Zoom in a listening session that we were both a part of several weeks ago on the music of, Anselm, the electronic music of Anselm.
Okay.
And she mentioned that Berlin was a very hard place to be right now because of the war in Ukraine. But I didn't ask her too much about that. But really what I wanted to ask about was pandemic. Right. How we're moving out of, at least over here in Canada, we're in a very interesting transition moment where live music is very much coming back, and all live performing arts, and mask mandates are disappearing. And I feel a sense of a band-aid being ripped off in a way that hasn't happened. So it hasn't felt so complete at earlier stages in the pandemic. It feels a bit more like this is really changing now. Okay. And so I'm curious with where you're situated, and you're now also returning to, it sounds like, a live performance, live installation life. But you've had these past 2 years, as we've all had, of probably some ups and downs, and really deeply different way of being in the world. And so I'm just curious if you've had any thoughts about what your practice is now versus what it was going into this time. Yeah.
I mean, of course, the last 2 years were completely insane for everyone. But it's interesting because we had been in Canada. We had been doing a tour in the United States and then ended in Canada to visit family right as the pandemic was hitting, basically. And we left Canada to return to Berlin 24 hours before they shut the borders. And so it was a crazy moment, of course, to return to Europe. And I'd only been living in Berlin for a year at that point. So it was very much like, is this home? Is this where we're going to be? Is this going to last for a month? Is this going to last forever? Like, what's happening? But Berlin actually ended up being a really great place to be through the pandemic, I have to say. Not only was the government very supportive of artists, and basically there was financial assistance and grants available for people to work on projects and things through it, but also there was always an option to, you could always socialize to some extent, even if you couldn't go out and go to bars and restaurants. So you always had the possibility to meet with friends. You were allowed to have people over for dinners. So you kind of had this sort of not normal, but a slight feeling of normalcy. And then there would be these moments where Europe would sort of open up. And so even during the two intense years of the pandemic, there were periods each year, a couple of periods where you could go and do concerts. So there, you could either do some in Berlin or Switzerland. I traveled to play a few times. Also Belgium. So there was always these sort of moments where things would happen. So when we finally, after Omicron, when things shifted in, February, March, all of a sudden I had tons of gigs all over the place. And I literally just got back from traveling a few days ago. And I've barely been home the last 2 months because there's just been so much going on, which has been amazing and felt really amazing. So in a weird sort of way, I think the period made me think about my practice more in the recording sense, different developments within my compositional approaches. Because there were periods where all I could do was work on recordings. Of course, I wasn't out in the world doing stuff. But I mean, and I live in a community here where probably I would say the most musicians in the world condensed in one city, which is really kind of overwhelming at times. But everyone we know is a musician, you know, everyone is a composer, a musician, and artists, of course, of all kinds, but everyone was just chomping at the bit to get back to it, you know, and that feeling of we're all back out in the world. I met friends just recently in Norway, and they're one from here, two from Paris, you know, friends from all the, and we all just meet and we're just like, yes, you know, okay. It's back. We're back. And strangely feels completely natural because it's what you do. You feel yourself again. And I feel lucky that in the last few years we had chances to do that. Even then there'd be a lockdown afterwards, or there would be all the venues would close again. But you'd have these little moments where you could kind of be reminded, oh, this is what we do. You know, this is who we are, this is what we do. This is important. Even just the first concert I went to after the first long lockdown, I remember almost being in tears, just sitting in a room with people. It wasn't even a great concert, to be honest, but it was like just so wonderful to be sitting in a room with people listening to live music together. Yeah. So that, yeah, I mean, I don't want to be naive, and I'm by no means am I like, yeah, it's all over. Who the hell knows what's coming? But I know that myself and most of my peers here are just like, okay, we're back to ourselves. We're back to life. Let's just keep rolling forward, you know? And I don't think it changed. I think it made us appreciate it again more, and I think a lot of us really needed the rest too, of actually being able to sleep in your own bed for like a few months is very bizarre. but yeah, I think it's like everybody's just, let's just get back to what we do.
You've been listening to The Drop and the Turning, a podcast about music, place, and change, produced in partnership between Newworks Calgary and CJSW Campus and Community Radio. My name is Rebecca Bruton. The works you've heard excerpted on the show today are dialogue between a Grand Master of the Knights Hospitalier and a Genoese sea captain, by Aura Clementi, which is Chris Cole with James Rushford, 2021. A Piece of Work by Chris Cole, 2022. Filling a Space with Salt, 2013. and Valid Forever 2021. Again, if you'd like to see Chris Cole and Oren Embarki live in Calgary at Highline Brewing on October the 24th, visit newworkscalgary.com or bugincision.com for more information and tickets.